ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, where we're still doing what we've done for nearly 40 years, examining what really matters in this changing world.
It's a power grab in advance.
And it felt fugitive, an alternative.
And people were willing to take risks.
Hear it now with four brand new episodes each week on the ABC Listen app.
Today on Future Tense, three perspectives on social media, disinformation and artificial intelligence. Perspectives that challenge our perceived understanding of the way big tech impacts democracy. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to the program. We start with Henry Farrell, a political scientist and professor of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University in the United States. Professor Farrell argues that the fundamental problem with social media is not that it misinforms individuals about what is true or untrue, but that it, quote, creates publics with malformed collective understandings. That's our starting point. Henry Farrell.
When we look at the ways in which people talk about the harms of social media, they very often concentrate on disinformation and misinformation. And here the idea is that you think about the harms of social media in terms of how they shape the ways in which individuals have certain kinds of beliefs about the world, that they believe that Barack Obama was a secret Muslim in the United States context, that they believe that Donald Trump, in fact, won the 2020 election. And so then if you think about the problem in that kind of way, you begin to start thinking about how it is that you can try to solve the problem, perhaps by taking individual level steps. So if you start thinking about it as a collective problem instead, you begin to look at the structures that shape the ways in which people respond to the world. And in particular, you begin to think about the way in which all of us, we have these collective beliefs because we act collectively in politics, because in a sense, we are all parts of publics. We are all looking to each other all the time in order to try and figure out what other people believe. And so if we're in a world where in effect, we are looking to other people and we have fundamentally mistaken understandings of what they believe. Well, this may lead us to pretend or half think that we believe things that we don't really believe in the first place. It may also cause us to stop talking about things that we actually do sincerely believe because we worry that other people are going to dislike us for it, because we think that they are going to regard us as in some way stepping out of the role that we should be actually pursuing. So really what I'm talking about here is the ways in which our beliefs about other people are fundamental to the ways in which we participate in politics. And if those beliefs are distorted by social media, then we're going to have a very distorted understanding of what is possible, what is not possible, who we are dealing with as potential allies, and what the beliefs are of people on the other side.
What makes social media different, though? We're social animals, in a sense. What makes the influence of a social media group different to previous groups?
So I think that, as you say, we have always had extremely distorted understandings of what other people believe. And if you want to see really nasty stuff, go back to the 19th century, go back to newspapers in the United States, go back in different ways, perhaps to political pamphlets that you get in the United Kingdom, and you will find a whole bunch of really nasty, really horrible stuff being said by people about their political opponents. So this has been, I think, always with us. What I think is new about social media is the way in which it is so fundamentally additive, so that you have really hundreds of thousands to millions to sometimes hundreds of millions of people participating in these spaces, and then people rising to the top as a result either of the algorithm or because of the ways in which group dynamics and group politics work. And the people who tend to rise to the top tend not to be particularly typical individuals in many ways. And hence, when we see those people, when we see the world through the eyes that are suggested by social media, we get a very different sense of what the world is like than we would have if we were just basing it on ordinary day-to-day interactions with people who we know pretty well. And this, of course, gets magnified when you see a situation like Twitter/X, where Elon Musk, who has a very, very peculiar set of political beliefs, really is able to reshape the fundamental algorithm of the social media service around his predilections, creating these kinds of feedback loops in which you really get, I think, a profoundly distorted understanding of how the world works if you spend too much time on Twitter.
So the division that we see in the world today, the argumentation, is the result of what? Of the creation of a whole range of different publics. We're not just talking about one public view, we're talking about many.
Yes, and you can think about this. What social media does is it takes the multitude of different publics that we used to have and it forges them, it melds them together into a single undistinguished blob. And to some extent, of course, this is an international blob in that people in Australia, in Ireland, where I come from, in the United States, they very often share the same kinds of broad social networks because we are all primarily English-speaking countries. And so you get these blobs forming, which are much, much bigger than anything we have had in the past. And one other function of this is that I think that this creates a situation in which, you know, we always have people who are strange, who are unhappy, who have all sorts of problems of one sort or another. In a world before social media, most of these people, they may have developed strange and idiosyncratic beliefs, but those beliefs tend to go in 100,000 different directions. If we're in a world of social media, and my colleague Cosma Shalitzi and I have done some mathematical simulation of this, if we're in a world of social media, what happens instead is that all of these unhappy people, their unhappinesses tend to glom together. They find themselves moving towards the same conversations. They are pulled in because it is much easier to search for other people who have the same beliefs. And so you get much, much easier, rapid dissemination of strange beliefs, which people coordinate on and converge upon in a way which probably would not have been possible back in the 18th, 19th, or even late 20th century.
So if you're correct, and if the big problem in our politics is malformed publics, as you've described them, rather than misinformed individuals, that's a much more difficult problem to fix, isn't it? And we're already struggling with this issue.
It really is. It really is a much more difficult problem to fix. And I think that, you know, if you think about the fixes, they are going to be slow fixes. They're going to be difficult fixes, which you apply over the process of years and decades rather than being able to flick a switch and get back into a better place. One thing that I would really emphasize is that a lot of this, you can think about this in terms of the demand side, why it is that people are so unhappy in the first place. And then you can also think about it in terms of the structures that are reshaping the ways in which they interact with each other. So it's really magnify a lot of the problems and to magnify a lot of very, very problematic understandings of the world and of the public. So I think one of the ways in which you could try to do this is really to try and figure out how to build back some of the social connections and ties that we used to have in previous decades on a more intimate, more personal level, and also look to try to connect them together to politics in ways that, again, have really faded away. So if you look back 30 or 40 years, you will see political parties, for example, played a much, much more direct and immediate role in people's lives. You actually knew your local representatives in different ways. If you wanted to get involved, you could get involved. And today, we live in a world where political parties don't serve that kind of bridging function. So in a sense, I think, you know, the one sentence version of this is that if you want to solve the problem of malformed publics, you need to build better publics, publics which better connect people to the politics that surround them in a way that give them some sense of control and of agency.
And presumably we have to move away from looking at the individual, at their knowledge and capacities. Why do we, though, still tend to look that way when we look at the problems that we have with misinformation, with disinformation, with democracy?
So I think part of this is just the way that we as human beings think. We tend to like to blame other people individually because that feels satisfying to us. A lot of this also has to do with the way that social sciences think. I'm a political scientist, and we, together with economists, tend very often to focus on individuals, to think about individual preferences, to think about individual beliefs, and not really to pay that much attention to the ways in which these congregate together, not to think in a certain sense about the ways in which the group level of politics really works. And so we have, again, there's good cognitive psychology, which suggests that groups can work in different ways. Some groups which force us to think together in a more systematic way, which expose our prejudices to each other, actually can work much, much better than any individual at reasoning about the problems that we have in the world. Other groups instead tend to reinforce and to exacerbate the kinds of problems of groupthink that we are all subject to. And so really we need to start thinking on the group level rather than the individual level. But again, that's hard for ordinary people. It's also hard for most social scientists given the intellectual habits we've developed over decades.
Henry Farrell, a professor of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University in the United States. And if you're interested in exploring Professor Farrell's argument in greater detail, you'll find a link to a recent article he wrote on the Future Tense website. To philosopher John Tassoulis now, the immediate former director of the Institute for Ethics and AI at Oxford. He's been looking at the concerns many of us share about the potential impact of artificial intelligence on our democratic system. And Professor Tassoulis argues that the current form of democracy that predominates in the West, representative democracy, well, he says it's too easily corrupted by big tech.
People too often now focus on the idea that AI is dangerous for democracy because people will be manipulated by AI algorithms on social media, etc. My view is that is a genuine concern, but it's overblown. I think there's a deeper ideological threat, and that ideological threat relates to the way in which AI technology, the way it's being presented to us, the way it's being presented as a possible sort of cure-all solution, undermines important aspects of what I call the democratic ethos. And one aspect of the democratic ethos is the idea that individual citizens have the capacities to engage in collective decision-making and deliberation about the common good. But increasingly what we're seeing is AI companies saying, actually, we're developing artificial general intelligence. This general intelligence is an automated system that can replicate human capabilities across the whole spectrum, that these systems will eventually outperform humans. And in outperforming humans, there's going to be a natural tendency to say they should replace human beings. And I think what's at risk there is a kind of sense of the diminution of our human capabilities and our human nature, that we will buy into the rhetoric of these companies that somehow we've been superseded by these machines that in fact, however, do not really replicate our capabilities because they don't, for example, have genuine understanding of the world the way that we do. They don't really have a capacity for rational autonomy to stand back from options and say, okay, this is what's been programmed into me, but should I follow this course of action? Humans have that capacity to stand back and assess various options, peer pressure, etc., stand back and assess them in terms of the reasons for and against. And I think the biggest worry is we'll increasingly have a reduction in our own sense of self-confidence as a species, and this will be driven by the powerful economic motives of these large corporations that are developing artificial intelligence.
And there's also a power shift at play, as you point out, isn't there, between the state and the corporation, which in itself also has an impact on democracy.
So alongside the ideological shift, whereby we start losing confidence and trust in our own human capabilities, there's also a power shift. And that power shift is the way in which these large tech corporations are increasingly taking over forms of activity that typically belong to the state. For example, to do with border control, law enforcement, to do with maintaining digital infrastructure. So they're moving into domains formally within the province of the state. And secondly, they're moving into those domains in a way that involves laying down rules for the rest of us. So they're kind of exercising a governmental function. Think about the way in which Meta is able to do content moderation, regulating the speech of people on its platforms, and uses this oversight board in order to do that. These are classically functions of the state. And one of the reasons we give the state these functions is because the state is democratically accountable to the rest of us. But the corporations carrying out these functions and not in the same way democratically accountable to the rest of us. And there's often a great deal of lack of transparency about what they're doing. So, for example, what kind of algorithm they're using in order to determine whether someone should get bail. There's lack of transparency about that, often because the corporation will say, well, that's our intellectual property, and therefore we're not required to disclose this to the rest of the world, even though it's having a huge impact on the lives of the people who are subject to that risk assessment tool.
Explain to us your criticism, skepticism of modern representative or liberal democracy and its ability to deal effectively with big tech.
Well, one argument could be that representative democracy enables a small class of professional politicians who are reliant upon the donations of large corporations. It enables that class to simply end up defending the interests of those large corporations. And that is certainly a problem in the American context, where you have got these large corporations and where you have Supreme Court decision that basically lift restrictions on these corporations supporting the politicians that they favor. So there is a sense that politicians as a professional class might be disconnected from the concerns of the ordinary people who are adversely affected by these technologies and too much subject to the control of a small number of special interests who are developing this technology. So how might you get beyond that? You would get beyond that by trying to develop a more participatory form of democracy that gives ordinary people more of a say, that it's not tethered to representatives actually defending the relevant view that the technology is having an adverse impact in various areas. Another way in which I think the classical model is helpful is that it doesn't necessarily restrict democracy to voting every 4 years or so. It talks about the idea of a more widespread democratic ethos, and that democracy and democratic decision-making can't just be at the level of formal legislation, but has to be more general. So one of the areas that I'm particularly keen on is democratizing the way that corporations work, including these big tech corporations. So who's making the decisions in these large corporations? In the case of Meta and Facebook, there's an oversight board composed of a dozen or so human rights experts. Now, why should they be making those decisions as opposed to also employees, also users of the platform? Why aren't they being engaged in the process of figuring out what the relevant standards are? And notice in the case of the Meta Oversight Board, there was a great emphasis on free speech and whether free speech was being infringed. But why should free speech be the right that's being prioritized in this context? Think about all those people in the global south who work for Meta doing data cleansing and so forth, subjected to violent images, degrading images, etc., as part of their work. What about their right to just and favorable conditions of work, for example? So the thought would be that one needs to have a more participatory approach that brings in the perspective of those adversely affected, and that this participatory approach to decision-making isn't limited to simply formal legislation, but affects institutions like large corporations that are now taking on increasingly governmental functions.
Do you see the possibility of artificial intelligence being used for pro-democracy purposes to encourage democracy?
So I think the big question that confronts us is not whether we're for or against artificial intelligence, but for what purposes is it being used? Is it simply being used to generate profits for already rich individuals, or is it being used in socially beneficial ways? And it seems to me that one of the ways in which AI can be socially beneficial is enabling this classical notion of democracy to be a more feasible option for us. Because the classic objection to classical democracy, if I can put it that way, is that it's too demanding. That how can you, especially in a modern state like Australia versus ancient Athens, a large pluralistic state, how can you genuinely foster decision-making in a really participatory way amongst the citizens? And what I argue in the paper is we have now a number of examples, including, for example, the use of the Polis platform by the Taiwan government, where you do actually see AI tools being used in such a way as to scale up democratic deliberation at the level of the nation state. So I think this is a crucial thing, that AI can be, as it were, the cure to its own problem, because if we direct AI towards facilitating democratic deliberation, then that will help us reach better decisions about how to deploy AI in the first place. So there is no doubt that there is that risk that's involved. But there's also a positive dimension to AI, which is if part of the reason why people are disaffected with democracy at the moment is that they feel that their representatives are not responsive to their values, then maybe AI can help us cure that problem by, as it were, bypassing those representatives and giving people a more effective voice. But in order for that to happen, we need democracy to be robust. And so there is a bit of a catch-22 problem. How that gets solved is going to be a very difficult question beyond the pay grade of a philosopher.
And a lowly broadcaster, no doubt. Ethicist Dr. John Tassioulis. And you're with Future Tense on ABC Radio National. I'm Anthony Fennell. Our theme in this program, three perspectives on social media, AI, disinformation and democracy. Marcus Beard is our final speaker today. He's a digital disinformation and AI specialist with Fenimore Harper Communications in the United Kingdom. He's also a former advisor to the British Prime Minister's Office on countering conspiracy theories. Now, Marcus has a new term for us, one which he argues better describes the proliferation of political disinformation and misinformation in our digital world. Fire away, Marcus.
Slopaganda is a contraction of two words, which should be obvious. This term AI slop and the word propaganda. So I think if we're talking about politics and public discourse, everyone's familiar with the idea of propaganda, of getting political messages across, getting support for political ideologies, points of view, not so much through fact-based debate, through statistics, through putting forward arguments like that. But, you know, propaganda refers to the imagery and narratives and playing on public feelings to further support for a political cause. And propaganda, it's been used for good and it's been used for bad. And that is combining now with this idea of AI slop, which refers to not just any AI-generated content. Some people call any AI content slop because they think it's all bad quality. But AI slop specifically refers to the huge volume of articles, images, videos being created with very, very low effort.
So how much political slopaganda is there out there?
So if you spend any amount of time consuming political content on TikTok or on Facebook, you will for sure encounter AI slop. It's very hard to tell exactly how much there is, but because it's being incentivized quite heavily by the platforms, it's growing exponentially at the moment.
And it's being incentivized, why? Because it attracts eyeballs, because it's contentious.
Yes, the AI slop that's being created is specifically going after contentious wedge issues. So in the UK, it is typically going after immigration narratives. So a lot of these videos are showing, the AI generated, showing people on small boats in channel crossings, and they'll have generated news presenter ask them why they came to the UK, and they'll say things like, oh, I want the UK government to give me a new phone to give me benefits, and I'm about to go start working for Deliveroo. It's designed to make people angry and to make people annoyed. And these platforms, for the longest time, the algorithms have been based on engagement. And if you engage with content, it'll get shown to more people. And the surest way to get engagement, which has been shown time and time again in studies, is to make something highly emotive. And the negative emotions also do better than positive emotions. And where the sort of incentive comes into it, some people just are posting the stuff because they get a kick out of getting loads of views and likes. That is a human condition to want to put stuff out there and have people see it. But now it's been supercharged even more by two things. One is the financial incentivization. So platforms like YouTube for a long time have had a program where if you post content and it gets lots of views, they can sell ads on it and you can get paid for it. Twitter has now introduced that in a big way since Elon Musk's purchase of the platform. And Facebook has now rolled that out a lot further. So there's a financial incentive to produce content. And if you can do that very cheaply with these AI tools with very low effort, that is what makes it such an exploding form of media that we're seeing. And I suppose there is one last aspect of it, which is, you know, this kind of content that has overtly sort of racist and prejudiced wouldn't have been allowed on the platforms, or would have been algorithmically decentralized or just outright removed even 2 or 3 years ago. But with Musk's purchase of Twitter, removing many, many of their moderation policies, it sort of forced all of the other platforms to also relax all of their moderation policies and allow a Wild West anything goes approach to it.
And it's important to point out that we're not just talking about political professionals here or propaganda professionals. We're talking about a wide range of people, as you indicated, making this stuff.
Exactly. And it is a range. Some of these people have no real skin in the game politically. They are just trying to make money, particularly on Twitter. A lot of these accounts stoking nationalist sentiment and divisive nationalist sentiment are not based in the UK. So there are all these accounts with sort of St. George flags and British bulldogs and talking about the Anglo-futurism. Some studies were done and a lot of them were based in Turkey. And it is because it is a surefire way to get loads of engagement and to get money. It's sort of a side hustle for these people. But also we saw recently that the president of the United States has been using AI-generated imagery for a long time on Truth Social.
An interesting observation that you make is that originally when generative AI arrived on the scene, people in politics were worried about very professional videos being posted of misleading quotes, say, from politicians, of deep fakes. But it turns out, you say that it's actually this mass-produced, low-quality stuff that's the real kicker, that's the real political problem.
When we first did our sort of investigations into how much of this AI content was out there, back in very early 2024, we found two campaigns that were using deep fakes of the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and then Keir Starmer, to promote a cryptocurrency scam. So it was tricking people into handing over their money. And at that time, people said, wow, this is being used to scam people. Imagine if it's used to scam people out of their votes. But even at that time, if you read our reports, we weren't predicting that there would be one big sort of deepfake moment, because those deepfakes can be debunked quite easily. And so it's very hard to build a narrative and a feeling and to convince people based on one single incident that can be easily debunked. There were instances of it, but they just weren't influential. What we feared and what is now happening is that there is an entire sort of fake universe of content that, again, people may not believe when they see it, but if they are mostly consuming, you know, images of things that didn't actually happen, if they try and remember the sort of facts of the day, the sort of real political moments, it's all jumbled in with this fake emotive false narrative content. So that is the real concern, rather than sort of a fake hot mic moment or a scandal, a single moment that has been generated and confected.
And just finally, what's the overall impact of this on our democracy, on our political process, do you think?
It's hard to tell at the moment what will happen. I don't think AI slopaganda is a single tactic, as a single trend, is going to sort of drive our democracy in one specific way. But I think it is a sort of a symptom and one of the many, many causes of just being driven apart more and more, not just in our political views, but also in our media consumption. And so what is happening more is that people are only consuming one type of content. And because people are using social media and consuming media so much, they are essentially living in a false reality. They do not have a very strong sense of what the real facts on the ground are. It is really what the facts are in their feed. That's been going on for a long time, decades, you could say. But I do think the danger is that these feeds, very often when you look at X and you look at Facebook, they are being controlled by people with a specific type of worldview, with specific economic and political interests. And so I think there is a real danger that the spaces that could be used for political debate, for cohesion, for finding solutions to the many problems we have, are being eroded in favor of this emotive, divisive discussion.
Well, Marcus Beard, thank you very much for your time.
Cool. Thank you very much.
And Marcus is with Fenimore Harbor Communications in the United Kingdom. Three thoughtful and at times philosophical perspectives on threats to democracy in the digital age. Our other guests were political scientist Henry Farrell and philosopher and ethicist John Tassioulis. Future Tense is an ABC Radio National production. The producer of this episode was Karin Savanovitz. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time. Cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.